mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways Magazine. The article is entitled, If Winter Comes, a story originally published in the January 1963 issue of Arizona Highways by Joyce Rockwood Munch. Winter, like everything else, is different in Arizona. There are three kinds, depending on where you are. Only the high mountains, the White Mountains, the San Francisco Peaks, and the Santa Catalinas know the real sleigh bell galosh and snowdrift variety. On rare and delightful occasions, those pranksters, Snow and the Game and Jack Frost, play truant on the heights, making brief raids down onto the mesas of the high desert to organize masquerades among Joshua trees or to powder the sage's hair. When the sun catches them at their innocent revels, the filmy white costumes, glittering icicles, and lacy filigreed ornaments are whisked away like Cinderella's ball gown at the stroke of midnight. Lower still, in Sororo Land, as palm trees whisper intimately to shimmering blue swimming pools, the traditional winter of ice and snow is only a memory, a half-forgotten experience which happened to someone else. Thus, the astringent season, which takes arbitrary command of a considerable part of the nation, approaches Arizona more in the guise of a salesman, offering tantalizing goods to be selected or refused. In those other states where snow, constant or intermittent, lies on the ground for months and low temperature is on constant guard to enforce winter's edicts, an almost martial law prevails. The diluted sunshine is rationed. Heavy clothing becomes a uniform. Curfews, sounded by chill winds, drive young and old earlier to their cozy homes. All the annual flowers succumb. Roses hibernate. Birds and big league teams fly south, while the populace makes do with football, skiing, and the opera season, just waiting for Cold War restrictions to be lifted. This admittedly prejudiced viewpoint might well be challenged, but it becomes the accepted one to those happy mortals wintering under gay patio umbrellas or even tending fields which can be miraculously replanted as soon as cleared of their last yield. The months clustering around Christmas are like a tossed coin. If you are lucky enough to turn up heads, meaning Arizona, you must paint your Yule windows with artificial snow crystals. If it's tails and you have to remain behind the snow curtain, then the Frost King will do it for you. Having thus disposed of winter as wholly undesirable, let's turn about completely and look at its charm. Arizona brand, of course. Arizona's sons and daughters, natural or adopted, would be the first to admit that snow, the more the better, has its place, up on the roof, covering gabled peaks of the White Mountains, or over four shingled stretches of the Kaibab Plateau and the open balconies of the San Francisco Peaks, and where frosty dormer windows in the Santa Catalina Range look down on Tucson's brilliantly sunny valley. Those are the capacious, frozen lockers that hold spring and summer supplies of water for the state's rivers and lakes. This admirable arrangement keeps one of Arizona's most carefully husbanded natural resources on ice, while transmitting, as well, a pleasant coolness to the lower living quarters. The sun takes a subdued course across the heavens, never achieving summer exuberance, and winds from the mountains' natural refrigerators help maintain a pleasant crispness of night on second-floor mesas in the downstairs desert. There are further advantages which the practical-minded will suggest for keeping a cool head. Foresters point out that the best timber grows slowly under the restraining hand of low temperatures. That is why nature has planted some 200 miles of ponderosa pines in the highlands to be wrapped in snow for several months every year. They breast Arizona skylines from the Utah border, sweeping up over Buckskin Mountain, the Paiute's name for the Kaibab, spreading over the shoulders of the San Francisco Peaks to flow into a dark green river south and east across the Mogollon Plateau through the White Mountains on into New Mexico. National forests protect, by restrictive use and selective cutting, the finest virgin stand of this species left on Earth. High slopes in the Chaska Range are similarly guarded and harvested by the Navajo Indian tribe. Nature, combining business with pleasure, makes winter in Arizona's high country both useful and beautiful. You should be there sometime among the mountains for its advent. There comes a day when the embers of autumn are almost burned out. The gold is gone from the aspen trees, the red from maple and sumac, yellow from oak and willow. You go to bed wondering when winter will come and wake up the next morning to find the miracle accomplished. Even before your eyelids or window shades are opened, the ear has caught the hush which only soundproofing snow brings. Outside, the world has been translated, and the forest children have hastily put on winter underwear. Whatever the view from your window showed yesterday, today there is a hand-woven tree-to-tree carpet. The sun is already drawing sparks of gold fire from it, as though the luxury-minded carpet maker had tossed out a bucket of diamonds for a final touch. If your vantage point be a snug weekend cabin in some highland eyrie, or hunting lodge where the season has surprised a party before the last shot, every tree and bush is touched by fantasy. Young pines bend to the ground under the accumulated weight of those delicate, geometrically shaped flakes, which individually seem no heavier than a butterfly kiss. Falling quietly but insistently, they dress the woods in ermine, using trees and shrubs as adjustable dress forms to create now a robed monk with reverently bowed head, now a prehistoric monster stretching out its arms. When the storm has passed, there is light and airiness through all the forest, a splendid play of beam and shadow. The blue of eyebrow pencil underscores each bush. Boulders wear marshmallow caps. The spectator may even feel an overwhelming sense of purity in this reborn world. The old is gone, and will this new one, so pristine in the clear air, be shaped nearer to the heart's desire? It's a wonderful time to wander through transformed landscapes. Better have snowshoes. No matter how tall you are, your legs no longer reach the ground, but flounder between a crust that gives way and the unwieldy white substance which hinders progress. Usual landmarks have been shifted. Hollows are leveled out, and hills and rocks assume new contours. Even the friendly trees seem strange, ghosts of their summer selves. Only you are still the same. But are you? A shortened and visible breath, sharp tingles that stir the blood and put color in your cheeks, hint at the quickened spirit within, responding to the transfiguration of the earth. Tracks in the blinding blanket of the snow tell of wild creatures about, startled into flight by your approach. The plunging step of a buck, weighted by his heavy crown of antlers, the short set marks of the rabbit, make little wells of shadow, giving perspective like in a dazzling field. The only sounds roll like ocean tides overhead, through the upper reaches of the trees, and underfoot in the tinkle and unquenchable chatter of some little stream. The company of small creeks and rivulets seem at their merriest in winter. Whether they be whistling in the dark or hurrying to keep warm, they appear determined to bolster the morale of every creature within earshot. Ice may turn to dam them, but the water slithers along beneath, alert for a weak spot it can break through and ready to gulp down as many starry snowflakes as the sky will feed them. Have you noticed how the flow caresses each rock in passing, erupting in little splashes every so often to point a chilly finger, complimenting the fancy bonnets that every stone is wearing? A close second in uninhabited chatter and running even ahead of a mountain stream in color contrast is a winter sport playground. Arizona has its snow bowl on the western slope of the San Francisco Peaks, Big Cienega in the White Mountains, and a third area on Mount Lemmon in the Santa Catalina Mountains, as well as more informal centers where sleds or slippery slats make winter the prime playtime. Anyone who can spare camera time from the dominant urge to ride a tow rope uphill so as to come down again at a dizzier clip has ample material to capture. From a lonely ski track, making unique pattern over an otherwise unblemished spread of snow, to jumpers in flight against the sky, candid shots on the beginner slope, the noisy tumult at refreshment stands, he might even catch a hint of the patent youth of even the oldest participant. Years seem to slide from the back, like a pilgrim's sack in the heady mountain air, or maybe they're washed away in the first snowdrift tumble. The fact remains, everyone is young on a ski slope. In Arizona, ski poles aren't the only kind to be carried in cars headed for winter fun in the mountains. There are fishing rods as well. The season never closes in this state, and anglers don't let a few feet of snow keep them from using line and reel. It's quite a sight, almost reminiscent of Little America, sans penguins, with well-bundled figures sitting in the midst of a white world on folding chairs or boxes around holes cut in the ice. Unsuspecting trout find themselves snatched from their element and quick frozen in the air. No extra charge to the winter Waltons. Enchanting as full-scale winter may be to some, not for everyone are the joys of snow and cold. Most people follow the sun to Arizona and mean to stay where its rays are most potent. The myth of Ponce de Leon's Fountain of Youth has been rewritten in modern terms. A special potion capable of renewing the spirit rather than aging bones is brewed in the special clarity of air in the low desert. A dry wine, including some unknown ingredient an earlier age would have labeled magic, it unwinds tense nerves, filters off the froth of needless worry and unrecognized dreads which dog our pressured 20th century minds. Winter in southern Arizona finds this draft most powerful. One of the recommended times for imbibing comes just after sundown when the air's particular lift induces deep breaths and a permeating sense of well-being. For these seasonal or permanent visitors, there are no fur-lined jackets or shoveling chores, but rather roses blooming outside the window in January and oranges to be picked from their own doorsteps, even in a house trailer estate. The saguaro cactus is their trademark against a frieze of black mountain peaks behind which the sun makes effective nightly exits. Even here, where the sun spends the winter, an echo of the seasonal pattern persists. Where man neither irrigates nor plows, plants settle down more for 40 winks than for a long winter's nap. Light rains may come, but the entire floral kingdom, each member fitted with built-in light meter and thermometer, waits for the spring solstice as surely as its northern relatives. Between these two realms, mountains decked out in the full panoply of snow and the serene mildness of lowlands, we have the high desert to explore in its winter aspect. At any season, this middle kingdom is alive with change and inconsistency, a buffer for the blending of low desert and mountains, sharing certain plants or climates of each. In a veritable laboratory for experimentation spelled out in unusual color and form. Geographically, it is mesa land, broad terraces planted to juniper, pinon, cypress, with generous measures of the noble cactus family, plus a wider variety of hardy vegetation than can be crammed into half a dozen books on botany. The terrain drops unaccountably into canyons, erupts in great uplifts, painted often in such raw colors that the conservative mind from north or east finds hard to believe. Here are such earthscapes as the Grand Canyon, the incredible mile depth from rim to river, Oak Creek Canyon broadening from paint-splashed cliffs into vermilion earth amphitheater, Monument Valley stabbing the sky with gigantic red fingers, Canyon de Chelly, cut in spacious meanders, which look up to tiny ancient houses mortised into caves on a 1,000-foot wall. It includes, among others, the Hopi Mesas, crowned by America's oldest communities, now beginning to trickle down in villages more accessible to car and electricity. Snow in this region becomes a pageant, a 90-day wonder. Visitations, seldom enough to make each a notable event, find formidable backgrounds for their dramatic turns. The white stuff, laid on perhaps through the night to achieve surprise, doesn't cover and hide. It decorates, new tones, variations on red and brown, when the sun wakes to what is going on, show off a brilliant contrast, delighting the eye with saturated colors. Sheer ramparts gain depth of tint from the moisture by the same chemical sleight of hand which restores store freshness to faded cotton dresses in the washer. Every level surface of eroded pinnacle and cliff, wide enough to hold banding of white, points up the difference between dazzling snow and the earthy tones of rock. Above all this, the sky is piercingly clear, seen from the foot of high walls, which the eye must first scale to reach the blue. The hue is so deep as to appear quite unreal. Snow plays other tricks on the mind among plants. Joshua trees, always grotesque, now add quaint mimicry to their repertoire. Jaunty stocking cap ermine cuffs at the end of bristling angular arms. Smaller yuccas manage equally humorous touches. Single rosettes may be steeped in cotton that winds a blanket close about them. Tall forms sport powdered wigs or fur-trimmed neckbands. While the mind analyzes snow is cold, the desert hot, the eye is digesting the joke, a sort of visual baked Alaska, ice cream browned in the oven. From the highest white-clad peak down to the lowest frost-free desert wash, winter is purposeful. Every melting snowflake can look toward reunion with the ocean and reincarnation as a raindrop. Every leaf falls toward some next year's flower, and a dried twig may yet join the fabric of tomorrow's most amply branching cottonwood tree. If only the faulty senses of the human organism were as expansive as man's spirit, we might actually see and hear, not just imagine in vague terms, forest and plain, canyon and mountain, rocks as well as plants and animals moving in a grand processional toward the recreation of spring. Until they are, we still have much to enjoy. Wherever you spend these evocative months, with eyes to see and ears to hear in the beautiful, varied, and complex land named Arizona, you can find stimulation in the profound declaration implied by the poet's query, "If winter comes, can spring be far behind?" This concludes "If Winter Comes." The next article is entitled "Thick and Thin." Thick-billed parrots have a long history in Arizona. The first documented sighting occurred in 1583, and the last took place in 1938. By most accounts, hunting, not habitat loss, decimated the local population. Although an attempt to reintroduce the endangered species came up short in the 1980s and 90s, supporters aren't giving up. This article is written by Matt Jaffe. What a glorious racket it must have been. What an incredible clamor filled the Chiricahua Mountains forest one August day in 1904, when a flock of as many as 1,000 thick-billed parrots descended on Bonita Canyon near Cochise Head. These birds, one of only two parrot species native to the United States, are not the retiring kind. They chatter and call, sometimes in single high-pitched squawks, audible more than a mile away, other times with staccato bursts that many people liken to human laughter. It's a fair bet that the miners in the area where the parrots appeared had never heard a bird make a sound like that, nor had they seen one so exotic, brilliant green, with scarlet across the forehead, above the eyes and on the shoulders. Boomerang-shaped yellow stripes on the underside of the parrot's wings flashed in the forest when the birds took flight. Even then, more than 30 years before the last Arizona sighting of wild, thick-billed parrots in 1938, the birds were not common in these mountains. So the miners considered the thick-billed parrots a sign of good fortune, though that didn't stop them from shooting several of the birds. Now, Arizona is home to 6 thick-bills, all in captivity. I go to the Phoenix Zoo for a closer look at 4 of these federally and internationally endangered birds whose remaining flocks are limited to high-elevation pine forests in Mexico's Sierra Madre Occidental Range. In 2013, the population in Mexico was estimated at nearly 2,100 birds. The zoo's parrots have prime digs with flyways connecting two separate enclosures, plus a couple of California condors for neighbors. Birdkeeper Lisa Murphy points out that the parrots have bonded into two pairs, one still tentative, the other well-established. Chattering contentedly, that second pair is beautiful to watch as the male feeds and preens his partner after she emerges from a hole in a climate-controlled nesting log. "Okay, now go back to the nest," Murphy says to the female. Turning to me, she adds, "I looked inside with a mirror on the end of a stick. They have an egg in there. This is the pair's third egg. The first was infertile. The second they broke." Murphy says it sometimes takes a few attempts for the birds to get things right. "I'm encouraged. As a wise woman once wrote, hope is a thing with feathers, and the egg symbolizes that there is still a future for a bird sometimes known as the Arizona parrot." Although questions remain about whether thick-billed parrots were sporadic or permanent residents of Arizona, their history here reaches deep into the Southwest past. Along with the remains of macaws brought in from Mexico and Central America, thick-billed parrot skeletons dating to as early as A.D. 1125 were found at Wupatki Pueblo, where the birds were used for ceremonial purposes. The birds also appear on Mimbres ceramics from New Mexico, and there is a parrot clan in Hopi society, while the Kayaro Katsina is a parrot-like figure associated with rain. The first documented sighting of what likely were thick-billed parrots dates to May 1583, when Antonio de Espejo's expedition, which explored the Rio Grande and the Verde Valley, described parrots by a river surrounded by an abundance of grapevines, many walnuts, and other trees. This reference is notable for both its early date and its northerly location outside present-day Flagstaff, where the parrots have never been spotted since. An encounter with thickbills was not just another bird sighting. In 1900, ornithologist Richard Lusk described a flock of the parrots scolding and chattering and calling in a language which was neither English nor Spanish, but may have been some Indian tongue, or indeed that of the old Aztecs of Mexico themselves. As their mountain forest habitat suggests, thickbills defy assumptions about parrots as tropical jungle-dwelling birds. For their primary food source, the parrots rely on pine seeds, especially those from Chihuahua pines, trees that reach the northern extent of their range in southeastern Arizona. Parrots hold and rotate the cones in one claw, systematically tearing off the scales with their bills to get at the seeds. It's a tricky enough maneuver that young parrots have to learn the technique from their parents before fledgling at about 5 months. Muscular and built like falcons, thickbills are dynamic, agile flyers. During breeding season, they can cover 100 miles or more a day in search of food, flying to foraging areas 15 to 20 miles from their nests several times. They're much faster in flight than hawks. A little edge and the hawks can't get them, says Noel Schneider, a retired wildlife biologist who helped direct the thickbill release program that began in the 1980s. He lives in Portal and is also the author of a book about the extinct Carolina parakeets, the U.S. parrot species last credibly sighted in the 1930s. Thickbills are very social birds, so with more eyes, the hawks can't sneak up on them as easily, Schneider says. The parrots habitually post sentinels. There's almost always one individual up top in the trees looking around. The thickbill's range includes altitudes of nearly 12,000 feet. They're one of the world's northernmost and highest elevation parrot species, which has earned them a seemingly contradictory nickname, snow parrots. In one account from the early 1900s, a rancher and mine owner wrote, "They would fly to a snow-covered limb, turn over, and grab the underside with their feet, woodpecker fashion, pulling themselves along with their bill after the acorns and occasionally dropping into the snow after those that fell. Wading in the snow with their short legs and solemn appearance was very ludicrous and gave us several laughs. The poor buggers were having such tough sledding that I hadn't the heart to kill them." That author was one of the few. By most accounts, hunting, not habitat loss, decimated the thick-billed parrot population in Arizona. In fairness to prospectors and others living and working in remote areas, the birds offered an easy subsistence food source. But farmers erroneously believed that the parrots ate crops and fruit in orchards. Still others shot thick bills for novel trophies. Between 1986 and 1993, the Arizona Game and Fish Department, in conjunction with the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, attempted to reintroduce the parrots into the Chiricahuas. The effort was based primarily on wild-caught birds that entered the illegal bird trade and were later confiscated from smugglers and aviculturalists, but parrots bred in captivity were also used. The agencies hoped to establish a separate population from flocks in Mexico, which were considered vulnerable to habitat loss by logging and fire. According to the conservation group BirdLife International, less than 1% of the Sierra Madre's old-growth forests survive. Schneider says that after decades free of logging, the forests of the Chiricahuas, though not pristine, presented promising habitat, but a combination of factors doomed the effort, which some likened to a federal feeding program for hawks. We learned two lessons, Schneider says. Don't use questionable birds and don't do releases unless you're confident that the habitat will be good for the bird. It may be more a romantic notion than an environmental reality, but some way, somehow, I'd love to one day hike in the Chiricahuas or Huachucas and suddenly see a flock of thick-billed parrots swoop into the pines. I'm not the only one. When I go to see the thick-billed pair at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum in Tucson, Shawnee Riplog Peterson, the museum's curator of mammalogy and ornithology, also muses about that almost mystical experience. What would it be like, she wonders, the sound, the color, just to be able to see something like that. And then, all of a sudden, they disappear in the trees. If they don't make a sound, you'd never see them. You could be staring right at them and never see anything. And these parrots are big, gorgeous, colorful birds. This concludes Thick and Thin. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas. And the outlaws I see in my dreams. Love.